By 1925, Harry had saved up a bit of money from the Hamahama job and used it to put a down payment on an auto repair and tire shop in Squim, on the north side of the Olympic Peninsula. The shop was located right downtown on Washington Street, the main thoroughfare through town, squarely on the route of anyone traveling from Seattle to Port Angeles or farther out onto the peninsula. It seemed a good location, and it got Harry back to doing what he loved most, tinkering with cars. The whole family moved into a small apartment over the shop. Joe enrolled in the Squim School. He spent his weekends helping his father work on cars, tinkering with carburetors and learning to vulcanize rubber, and partly out of eagerness to stay out of Tula's way upstairs. When the mayor of Squim smashed up Harry's Franklin while ogling a passing girl, breaking its wooden frame, he bought Harry a newer model, and Harry gave Joe the older Franklin so he could learn by repairing it. A second daughter, Polly, was born that year, and as his business took root, Harry bought a stump farm, 160 acres of recently logged land southwest of town. There he began to build, with his own hands, a large farmhouse. Squim sat on a wide expanse of prairie between the snow-capped Olympic Mountains to the south and the broad blue strait of Juan de Fuca to the north. Vancouver Island was just visible on the horizon. Nestled in the lee of the mountains, sheltered from the storms that rotated in off the Pacific from the southwest, the area was far less rainy than most of western Washington, and the skies were blue more often than gray. The weather was so dry, in fact, that early settlers had found cacti growing in places. It was the kind of town where people got together on weekends to build a new church to hold Sunday afternoon ice cream socials, or to kick up their heels at Saturday night square dances. In Squim, your butcher might also be the volunteer firefighter who saved your house or barn, as well as the neighbor who helped you rebuild it. It is a place where native women from the nearby Jamestown Sklallam tribe might share recipes with a Protestant minister's wife over a cup of coffee at Drake's Cafe. Where old men sat in front of the post office on Saturday afternoon, spitting brown arcs of tobacco juice into strategically arranged spittoons. Where boys could sell melons purloined from local vegetable patches to Honolulu Pete at his fruit truck parked on Seal Street. Where children could wander into Layman's Meat Market and be given a free hot dog in a bun just because they looked hungry. Or where they might stop by Brayton Drugstore and be handed a piece of candy just because they said, please. The farmhouse that Harry set about building amid the tree stumps outside of town became a work perpetually in progress. With Joe's help, he dug a ditch to divert water, illegally, from an irrigation canal flowing out of the nearby Dungeness River. He rigged up a sawmill powered by the water he had diverted. He felled a few crooked trees left behind by the lumber company that had recently logged off the property, and then milled enough rough-cut lumber to frame the two-story house and apply cedar siding to part of it. He and Joe collected smooth river rocks from the Dungeness and laboriously erected an enormous stone fireplace. The house was still only half completed when he decided to sell the car repair shop and move his family out to the stump farm. Over the next few years, Harry and Joe kept pounding nails when they had the time. They built a wide front porch and a woodshed, a ramshackle hen house that soon became home to more than 400 chickens, and a rickety milking barn for half a dozen dairy cows that grazed among the stumps. Harry rigged a flywheel and generator to the water wheel that powered his sawmill, ran electrical wire into the house, and dangled light bulbs from the rafters. As the supply of water from the irrigation ditch waxed and waned, the lights flickered on and off and glowed with varying degrees of intensity. But he never quite got around to finishing the house. To Joe, the condition of the house made little difference. Once again, he had the semblance of a home and a new world to explore. Behind the house, there was a meadow of nearly an acre, carpeted in summer with sweet wild strawberries. During the spring, water flowed over his father's water wheel with such force that it excavated a pool nearly 10 feet deep and 25 feet long. Soon, salmon and steelhead and trout from the Dungeness made their way up the irrigation ditch and gathered in schools in the pond. Joe rigged up a net on a long pole, and whenever he wanted a fish for dinner, he simply took the net out behind the house, picked out a fish, and hauled it in. The woods just beyond the property were full of bears and cougars. That troubled Tula and made her understandably nervous about her flock of small children, but Joe thrilled at night when he heard the bears splashing as they fished in the pond, or the cougars screeching as they met their mates in the dark. Joe was a good and popular student. His classmates found him outgoing, freewheeling, handy with a joke, and fun to be around. A few who got to know him better found that he could suddenly and unexpectedly turn somber. Never nasty or hostile, but guarded, as if there was a part of him he didn't want you to touch. He was a particular favorite of Miss Flutibo, the music teacher. Through barter and the generosity of a few friends, he soon owned a ragged collection of old stringed instruments, a mandolin, several guitars, an old ukulele, and two banjos. Sitting on the front porch every day after school, working at it again at night when his schoolwork was finished, he patiently and painstakingly taught himself to play each instrument proficiently. He took to carrying one of the guitars onto the school bus every day. He sat in the back, playing and singing the songs he loved, boisterous tunes from vaudeville acts he had heard on the radio, long comical ballads, and sad, lilting cowboy songs, entertaining the other students, drawing groups of them toward the rear of the bus to listen and sing along with him. It wasn't long before he found that he had one particular devotee, a pretty slip of a girl named Joyce Simdars, with blonde curls, a button nose, and a fetching smile, who more and more often sat next to him, singing along in perfect two-part harmony. To Joe, Squim was shaping up to be near paradise. For Tula, though, it was yet another disappointment, not much of an improvement over Boulder City, her parents' basement, or the apartment over the tire shop. Stuck in a half-finished house, surrounded by rotting stumps and wild animals of all sorts, she felt as far removed as ever from the sophisticated life that she had envisioned for herself. Everything about farm life appalled her. The daily milking of cows, the ever-present stench of manure, the relentless collecting of eggs, the daily cleaning of the cream separator, the always flickering light fixtures hung from the rafters. She despised the endless chopping of kindling to feed the wood stove, the early mornings and the late nights, and she was perpetually irritated by Joe and his teenaged friends and their makeshift bands out on the wide front porch making a racket day and night. All these miseries seemed compounded into a single horrific moment one misty winter morning, when she turned from the wood stove with an iron skillet full of hot bacon grease, potatoes, and onions, and tripped over Harry Jr., who was lying on his back on the floor. She dropped the skillet and its contents directly onto the boy's neck and chest. She and her son screamed simultaneously. Harry ran out the door, tore off his shirt, and threw himself into a snowbank, but the damage was done. His chest was hideously burned and blistered. He survived, but only after contracting pneumonia, spending weeks in a nearby hospital, and missing a full year of school. After that, things began to sour once more for the whole family. In the fall of 1929, a hole opened up in Joe's life. Joyce Simdar's family home burned to the ground on the night of September 29th, while the family was away. Joyce was sent off to live with an aunt in Great Falls, Montana, until the house could be rebuilt. All at once, the bus ride to school was not what it had been. A month later came a much more serious calamity. The rural economy of the United States had already been in desperate straits for some time by that fall. Huge surpluses of wheat, corn, milk, pork, and beef produced in the Midwest had caused the price of farm commodities to crash. Wheat brought in only a tenth of what it had 9 or 10 years before. In Iowa, a bushel of corn fetched less than the price of a packet of gum, and the price collapse began to spread to the far west. Things in Squim were not yet as hard as on the Great Plains, but they were hard enough. The Rance farm, like countless others across the country, had so far barely managed to remain profitable. But when they picked up the Squim Press on October 30th and read what had happened in New York over the last several days, Harry and Tula Rance knew with cold certainty that the world had utterly changed, that they would not long be sheltered from the storm on Wall Street, not even in Squim, out in the far northwestern corner of the whole country. Over the next few weeks, things continued to unravel at the Rance house on Silberhorn Road. A week after the financial crash, wild dogs began to appear daily on the farm. Dozens of families had simply walked away from their homes and farms in Squim that fall, many leaving dogs behind to fend for themselves. Now, packs of them began chasing the cows all over the ranch property, relentlessly nipping at their legs. The bellowing, distressed cows lumbered among the stumps until they were exhausted and stopped giving the milk that was the farm's principal cash product. 2 weeks later, minks stole into the hen house and slaughtered dozens of chickens, leaving their bloody corpses piled up in the corners. A few nights later, they did it again, almost as if for sport. And now the egg money dwindled away. Harry Jr. would later say of events that fall, "Everything just stopped dead in the water. It was almost as if someone said to God, 'Go after them.'" Then, late one rainy afternoon in November, the school bus dropped off Joe just as darkness was enveloping the house. Walking up the driveway to the house, stepping over potholes full of rainwater, Joe noticed his father's Franklin, its engines running, plumes of white exhaust billowing from the tailpipe. Something was tied to the roof of the car with a tarpaulin over it. As he drew nearer, he saw that the younger kids were sitting in the back seat among suitcases and peering out at him through steamy windows. Tula was sitting in the front seat staring straight ahead, looking at the house, where Harry stood on the porch watching Joe approach. Joe mounted the porch steps. His father's face was drawn and white.
"What's up, Pop? Where are we going?" Joe murmured.
Harry looked down at the boards planking the porch, then raised his eyes and gazed off into the dark, wet woods over Joe's shoulder. "We can't make it here, Joe. There's nothing else for it. Tula won't stay at any rate. She's insisting."
"Well, where are we going to go?"
Harry turned to meet Joe's eyes.
"I'm not sure.
Seattle, for now. Then California, maybe."
"But, son, the thing is, Tula wants you to stay here.
I would stay with you, but I can't. The little kids are going to need a father more than you are. You're pretty much all grown up now anyway." Joe froze, his gray-blue eyes locked onto his father's face, suddenly blank and expressionless, like stone. Stunned, trying to take in what he had just heard, unable to speak, Joe reached out a hand and laid it on the rough-hewn cedar railing, steadying himself. Rainwater, dripping from the roof, splattered in the mud below. Joe's stomach lurched. Finally he sputtered, "But can't I just come along?"
"No, that won't work."
"Look, son, if there's one thing I've figured out about life, it's that if you want to be happy, you have to learn how to be happy on your own." With that, Harry strode back to the car, climbed in, closed the door, and started down the driveway. In the back seat, Mike and Harry Jr. peered through the oval rearview window. Joe watched the red taillights recede and disappear into a dark shroud of rain. He turned and walked into the house and closed the door behind him. The whole thing had taken less than 5 minutes. The rain was thundering on the roof now. The house was cold and damp. The light bulbs hanging from the rafters flickered on for a moment. Then they flickered off and stayed off. Rain was still pounding the roof of the half-finished house in Squim when Joe woke up the next morning. A wind had come up during the night, and it moaned in the tops of the fir trees behind the house. Joe lay in bed for a long time, listening, remembering the days he had spent lying in bed in his aunt's attic in Pennsylvania, listening to the mournful sound of trains in the distance, with fear and aloneness weighing on him, pressing down on his chest, pushing him into the mattress. The feeling was back. He did not want to get up. Did not really care if he ever got up. Finally, though, he did get up. He made a fire in the wood stove, put water on to boil, fried some bacon, made some coffee. Very slowly, as he ate the bacon and the coffee cleared his mind, the spinning in his head began to diminish, and he found himself creeping up on a new realization. He opened his eyes and seized it, took it in, comprehended it all at once, and found that it came accompanied by a fierce determination, a sense of rising resolution. He was sick and tired of finding himself in this position, scared and hurt and abandoned and endlessly asking himself why. Whatever else came his way, he wasn't going to let anything like this happen again. From now on, he would make his own way, find his own route to happiness, as his father had said. He'd prove to his father and to himself that he could do it. He wouldn't become a hermit.
He liked other people too much for that, and friends could help push away the loneliness. He would never again let himself depend on them, though, nor on his family, nor on anyone else, for his sense of who he was. He would survive, and he would do it on his own. The smell and taste of the bacon had stimulated his appetite mightily, and he was still hungry. He got up and rummaged through the kitchen to take inventory. There wasn't much to be found. A few boxes of oatmeal, a jar of pickles, some eggs from the chickens that had survived the mink attacks, a half a head of cabbage and some bologna in the icebox. Not much for a 15-year-old boy already approaching 6 feet. He made some oatmeal and sat back down to think further. His father had always taught him that there was a solution to every problem, but he had always stressed that sometimes a solution wasn't where people would ordinarily expect it to be, that you might have to look in unexpected places and think in new and creative ways to find the answers you were looking for. He remembered the mushrooms on the rotten logs in Boulder City. He could survive on his own, he figured, if he just kept his wits about him, if he kept his eyes open for opportunities, and if he didn't allow his life to be dictated by other people's notions of what he should do. Over the next few weeks and months, Joe began to learn to fend entirely for himself. He drove iron stakes into the ground to fortify the chicken coop against future mink attacks, and treasured the few eggs he gathered every morning. He foraged in the dripping woods for mushrooms, and with all the recent rain he found basketfuls of them, beautiful fluted orange chanterelles, and fat, meaty king bullets that he fried in some bacon grease Tula had saved in a tin can. He gathered the last of the autumn's blackberries, netted the last of the fish from the pool behind the water wheel, picked watercress and added berries and made salads of them. Berries and watercress would only go so far, though. It was clear that he was going to need some money in his pocket. He drove downtown in the old Franklin his father had left behind and parked on Washington Street, where he sat on the hood and played his banjo and sang, hoping for spare change. He soon found that there was no such thing as spare change in 1929. The crash had started on Wall Street, but it quickly brought down communities from coast to coast. Downtown Squim was desolate. The State Bank of Squim was still afloat, but would fail within months. More and more storefronts were boarded up every day. As Joe sang, dogs sat on their haunches on the wooden sidewalks watching him idly, scratching their fleas in the rain. Black cars bounced down the unpaved street, splashing through muddy potholes, sending up jets of brown water. But the drivers paid Joe little heed. About the only audience he could count on was a bearded character everyone called the Mad Russian, who had been wandering Squim streets barefoot and muttering to himself for as long as anyone could remember. Joe dug deeper into his imagination. Months before, he and his friend Harry Secor had discovered a spot on the Dungeness River where huge Chinook salmon, some as much as 4 feet long, lay in a deep, green, swirling pool, waiting to spawn. Joe found a gaff hook in a barn and began to carry it secreted in his pocket. Early one misty Saturday morning, he and Harry worked their way through a dripping tangle of cottonwoods and alders lining the Dungeness, evading the game warden who regularly patrolled the river during salmon spawning season. They cut a stout pole from a young alder, lashed the gaff hook to it, and then stealthily approached the swift, cold river. Joe took off his shoes, rolled up his pants, and waded quietly into the shallow riffles upstream from the pool. When Joe was in position, Harry started throwing large river rocks into the pool and beating the surface with a stick. In a panic, the fish dashed upstream toward Joe in the shallows. As they flashed by, Joe aimed the gaff at one of the largest of them, thrust the pole into the water, and deftly snagged the fish under the gills, where the hook would leave no telltale marks. Then, amid much shouting and splashing, he stumbled out of the water and dragged the thrashing salmon up onto the gravel bank. Joe feasted on salmon that night, alone in the house. Then he set about turning the poaching of salmon into a business. Each Saturday afternoon, Joe hiked the 3 miles into town with one or more of the enormous salmon slung over his shoulder on a willow switch, their tails dragging in the dust behind him. He delivered his catch to the back door of Lehman's Meat Market and to the back doors of various households around Squim, where he sold them for cash or bartered them for butter or meat or gas for the Franklin or whatever else he needed that week, solemnly and good-naturedly assuring his customers that, yes, indeed, he had caught the fish on a hook and line, fair and square. Later that winter, he found another entrepreneurial opportunity. With Prohibition in full swing and Canada just 15 miles across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Squim was a lively port of entry for hard spirits of all sorts. Much of it made its way to the speakeasies of Seattle, but one bootlegger specialized in local customers. Byron Noble roared into the outskirts of town every Friday night in a long, sleek black Chrysler, depositing hip flasks full of gin, rum, or whiskey behind particular fence posts where his customers knew to look for them. Soon, Joe and Harry Secor also knew where to look for them. Dressed in dark, heavy clothes on frosty nights, they followed Noble around on his nocturnal route, pouring the contents of selected flasks into fruit jars and replacing the liquor with dandelion wine they had brewed themselves in Joe's barn. That way, they figured, rather than seeming as if someone had stolen the goods, it would seem to Noble's customers that they had simply gotten a bad batch of hooch. But they were careful not to purloin too often from the same location, fearful that Noble or his customers might be lying in the weeds, waiting for them with a shotgun. After a night's work, Joe silently delivered the fruit jars full of the good stuff to the fence posts of his own discreetly cultivated clients. When he wasn't poaching fish or stealing booze, Joe worked at any kind of legitimate work he could find. He dug tunnels under stumps in his neighbor's pastures and pried them out of the earth with long iron bars. When prying didn't work, he stuffed sticks of dynamite under them, lit a fuse, and ran like hell as the dynamite sent the stumps and a black plume of dirt and rocks high into the air. He stooped and scraped with a shovel, digging irrigation ditches by hand. With a long-handled, double-edged axe, he split fence rails from massive cedar logs that washed down the Dungeness in the spring. He dug wells, he built barns, crawling around in the rafters and pounding nails. He hand-cranked cream separators and lugged 120-pound cans of milk and sweet cream around dairy farms, loading them onto trucks for delivery to the Dungeness Squim Cooperative Creamery. As summer came on, he labored under pale blue skies in the dry fields surrounding Squim, cutting hay with a scythe, forking it onto wagons, and hoisting it by the ton into the lofts of his neighbor's barns. In all this, Joe grew continually stronger and ever more self-reliant. Through it all, he stayed in school and earned good grades. At the end of the day, though, he remained stoically alone, returning each night to the empty, half-finished house. He ate solitary meals, sitting at one end of the large dining table where his family had previously gathered for boisterous dinners. Each night he washed the one plate he used and wiped it dry and set it back in its place on top of the stack of dishes Tula had left behind in a kitchen cabinet. He sat down at his mother's old piano in the front room and plinked at the keys and floated simple melodies through the dark, empty spaces of the house. He sat on the front steps and played his banjo and sang quietly to himself. In the months that followed, Joe hunted for new opportunities in Squim. Just down Silberhorn Road, he found part-time work helping his older neighbor, Charlie McDonald. McDonald made his living logging, harvesting enormous cottonwood trees that grew in the gravelly bottomlands along the Dungeness River. The work was backbreaking. The cottonwoods were so immense, their diameters so great, that it sometimes took an hour or more for Joe and Charlie to fell just one, pulling an 84-inch two-man saw back and forth through the soft white heartwood. In the spring, when the sap was running, it jetted up out of the stumps 3 or 4 feet into the air after the trees finally toppled over. Then Joe and Charlie lopped off all the branches with axes, pried the bark from the logs with long iron bars, and harnessed them to Charlie's draft horses, Fritz and Dick, so they could be dragged out of the woods and sent off to a pulp mill in Port Angeles. Charlie had been gassed in the Great War, his vocal cords all but destroyed. At best, he could manage croaks and whispers. As they worked together, Joe marveled at how Charlie could command the ponderous draft horses to do his bidding with barely an audible gee or haw, or, as often as not, simply a whistle and a nod of his head. Charlie would give a signal, and in unison, Fritz and Dick would squat down on their haunches while he chained them up. He'd give another signal, and the two would rise and pull as if they were one horse, their movements crisply synchronized. And they pulled with all their hearts. When horses pulled like that, Charlie told Joe, they could pull far more than twice what each could pull alone. They'd pull, he said, till the log moved, the harness broke,
or their hearts gave out. In time, Joe began to take some of his evening meals with the McDonald family in exchange for his labor. He quickly became enormously popular with their preteen daughters, Margaret and Pearlie, staying after dinner and late into the evenings most nights, strumming his banjo and singing for the girls, or lying on the braided carpet in the front parlor, playing dominoes, mahjong, or pick-up sticks with them. He soon found another way to make a few dollars, while entertaining himself as well. He and two of his school friends, Eddie Blake and Angus Hay, Jr., formed a three-man band, with Joe on banjo, Eddie on drums, and Angus on saxophone. The trio played jazz tunes during intermissions at the Olympic Movie Theater in Squim in exchange for an opportunity to watch the films. They played for square dances at the Grange Hall in Carlsborg. On Saturday nights, they played at a dance hall in nearby Blinn, where a farmer had turned, with the addition of some strings of electric lights, his chicken coop, into Squim's most popular dance venue. Girls were admitted to the chicken coop free of charge, boys for 25 cents, but Joe and his bandmates paid no admission when they performed. That meant a lot to Joe. Several weeks earlier, Joyce Simdars had returned from Montana, and free admission meant that he could afford to bring her along on dates. He soon found, to his chagrin, though, that she was allowed to go only rarely, only when her mother was available to accompany her, riding primly and vigilantly in the wide plush back seat of the Franklin, taking control of the dangerous territory. If there was one thing in the world Joyce Simdars wanted, it was for her mother to be less vigilant. The Simdars household was austere, Joyce's upbringing severe. Descended from German and Scottish immigrants who had settled in Squim as pioneers, her parents both believed that work was an end in itself, that it straightened a wayward soul, and that no amount of it was too much. Joyce's father, in fact, was well on his way to working himself to death. Suffering from an enlarged heart and inflammatory rheumatism, he nevertheless continued to plow his fields the old-fashioned way, behind a team of mules. By the end of his life, the mules would be more or less dragging him across the field from shortly after dawn till evening, sometimes 6 days a week during planting season. But it was Joyce's mother, and in particular her mother's religious views, that most oppressed Joyce. Enid Simdars embraced the strictures of Christian Science, a faith that taught that the material world and all the evil that attended it were illusory, that the only reality was spiritual. This meant, among other things, that prayer, and only prayer, could heal afflictions like the rheumatism that afflicted Joyce's father, and that doctors were a waste of time. It also meant something that affected Joyce even more personally, as she was growing up. Enid believed there was only a good Joyce, that a bad Joyce was a theological impossibility, that any such person who might appear was, by definition, an impostor in the guise of her daughter. When Joyce misbehaved, she simply ceased to exist for her mother. The bad Joyce was made to sit on a chair and was not acknowledged in any way, or allowed to leave the chair until the good Joyce spontaneously reappeared. As a result, Joyce had spent much of her childhood wrestling with the notion that any wicked thought or misbehavior on her part meant that she was not worthy of love, and, in fact, was in imminent danger of ceasing to exist. Years later, she remembered sitting in the chair sobbing, and checking on herself over and over again, thinking, "But I'm still here. I'm still here." If she had a refuge, it was in working out of doors rather than in the house. She detested housework, in part because it had no end in the Simdars household, and in part because it held her under the bell jar of her mother's watchful eye. And it did not help that since her mid-teens, Joyce had begun to suffer from arthritis, apparently a genetic gift from her father. The endless washing of dishes and scrubbing of floors and wiping of windows was the kind of repetitious work that aggravated the pain in her hands and wrists. Whenever she had a chance, she slipped outdoors to work in the vegetable garden or to tend to the animals with her father. He was hardly effusive with his affection, more apt to cuddle the family dog than one of his children, but at least he always seemed vaguely glad to have her around, and Joyce found the farm work he did more interesting than housework. It often involved solving practical problems or making something new, and that appealed to her considerable and burgeoning intellectual curiosity, a curiosity that had already made her an unusually proficient student at school, scholarly even,
She was always eager to delve deeply into whatever piqued her interest, everything from photography to Latin. She loved logic, loved to take things apart and put them back together, whether it was a speech by Cicero or a windmill. At the end of the day, though, dishes and more housework and her mother's vigilant eye always waited for Joyce in the dark and close confines of the house. And so, when Joyce had first laid eyes on Joe Rance, sitting in the back of the school bus, strumming a guitar, singing some funny old song and flashing his big, white, toothy grin, when she had first heard his boisterous laugh and seen mirth in his eyes as he glanced up the aisle at her, she had been drawn to him, seen in him at once a window to a wider and sunnier world. He seemed the very embodiment of freedom. She knew what his circumstances were, knew how marginal his existence was, how poor his prospects. She knew that many girls would turn away from a boy like this, and that perhaps she should as well. And yet, the more she observed how he handled those circumstances, how strong he was, how resourceful he could be, how he, like she, enjoyed the challenge of solving practical problems, the more she came to admire him. In time, she also came to understand that he, like she, lived with self-doubt gnawing continually at his heart. Most of all, she marveled at and exulted in the simple and undeniable fact that he seemed to care for her just as she was, good or bad. Slowly she resolved that some day she would find a way to compensate for the way the world had so far treated Joe Rance. In the summer of 1931, Joe received a letter from his brother Fred, now a chemistry teacher at Roosevelt High School in Seattle. Fred wanted Joe to come to Seattle to live with him in Thelma and take his senior year at Roosevelt. If Joe graduated from a school as highly regarded as Roosevelt, Fred said, he just might be able to get into the University of Washington. From there, anything might be possible. Joe was wary. Since Fred had first taken him in back in Nez Perce when he was 5, Joe had always felt that Fred was a bit overbearing, bent perhaps as much on directing Joe's life as helping him out. Fred had long seemed to think that his little brother was just a bit inept, and that he needed to set him straight on any number of things. Now, just as Joe was finally beginning to get his feet under himself, to make it on his own, he wasn't at all sure he wanted Fred, or anyone else for that matter, telling him how to live his life. He wasn't sure he wanted to live with Tula's twin sister either, and he had not really contemplated going to the university before. Still, as he pondered Fred's letter, the notion began to work on him. He'd always done well in his classes. He was insatiably curious about any number of subjects, and he liked the idea of testing his intellectual abilities. More than that, though, he knew that Squim was never likely to offer him a path to the future he was starting to imagine, a future that centered on Joyce Simdars and a family of his own. To get there, he knew, he would have to leave Joyce behind, at least for now. In the end, he boarded up the house in Squim, told Joyce he'd be back at the end of the school year, took the ferry to Seattle, moved in with Fred and Thelma, and started attending Roosevelt. It was a strange turn. For the first time in as long as he could remember, he found himself with 3 square meals a day and little to do except attend school and explore his interests. He threw himself into both. Again, he excelled in the classroom, and quickly worked his way onto the dean's list. He joined the glee club and relished the opportunity it gave him to sing and perform in plays and make music. He signed up for the men's gymnastics team, where his prodigious upper body strength made him a standout on the rings, the high bars, and the parallel bars. At the end of the day, he sometimes went out on the town with Fred and Thelma, eating in real restaurants, taking in Hollywood movies, even going to musicals at the Fifth Avenue Theater. It seemed to Joe a life of extraordinary ease and privilege, and it confirmed what he had been thinking. He did want something more out of life than what Squim could offer. One spring day in 1932, as Joe was practicing giants on the high bar in the gym, he noticed a tall man in a dark gray suit and a fedora standing in the doorway and watching him intently. The man disappeared, but a few minutes later, Fred walked into the gym and called Joe over to the door. "A fellow just came into my classroom and asked who you were," Fred said. "Said he was from the university. He gave me this. Said you should look him up when you get to the U, that he might be able to use a fellow like you." Fred handed Joe a card, and Joe glanced down at it. "Alvin M. Ulbrichsen, Head Coach, Crew, University of Washington Athletic Department." Joe pondered the card for a moment, then walked to his locker and put it in his wallet.
It couldn't hurt to give it a try. Rowing couldn't be any harder than cutting cottonwoods.
By the summer of 1932, Joe had graduated from Roosevelt with honors and was back in Squim. If he was really going to attend the university, he was going to need to scrape together enough money for rent and books and tuition. It would take him a year just to earn enough for his freshman year. He'd worry about the second year and the third and the fourth later. Joe was glad to be home. As he had feared, in Seattle, Fred had directed his every move. It had been with the best of intentions, Joe was sure, but he had felt suffocated by the ceaseless rejoinders and advice on everything from what classes to take to how to tie his necktie. Fred had even suggested that he date particular girls at Roosevelt, suggesting that the Simdars girl out in Squim might be a bit of a country bumpkin, and that perhaps he should set his sights a little higher on a city girl. And there had been something else. As the year went by, Joe had gradually begun to suspect, and then to believe, that Fred and Thelma knew exactly where his father, stepmother, and half-siblings were, and that they were not far away. There had been bits of conversation overheard, topics abruptly dropped, glances hastily averted, phone calls carried on with muffled voices. Joe had thought about confronting them, but he'd always reconsidered, pushed the subject out of his mind. The last thing he wanted to know was that his father was nearby and making no effort to reach out to him. In Squim, Joe worked continuously. He counted himself lucky when he landed a summer job with the Civilian Conservation Corps, laying asphalt for the new Olympic Highway for 50 cents an hour. The money was decent. The work, brutal. For 8 hours a day, he shoveled steaming asphalt out of trucks and raked it out flat in advance of the steamrollers. The unrelenting heat rising from the black asphalt, melding with the heat from the sun overhead, as if the two sources were competing to see which would kill him first. On weekends, he cut hay again with Harry Secor and dug irrigation ditches for local farmers. By winter, he was back in the woods with Charlie McDonald cutting cottonwoods, chaining them to the draft horses and skidding them out of the woods in snow and sleet. But there was a saving grace. Almost every afternoon now, Joyce got off the school bus on Silberhorn, down by the river, rather than at her home in Happy Valley. She rushed through the woods looking for Joe. When she found him, he always hugged her tight, smelling, as she would remember 70 years later on her deathbed, of wet wood and sweat and the sweet wildness of the outdoors. One radiant day in late April, she hurried to Joe as usual. When she found him, he took her hand and led her to a small meadow among the cottonwoods on the south bank of the Dungeness. Joe sat her down in the grass and asked her to wait a moment. He wandered a few feet off and sat down and began to inspect the ground carefully, pawing through the grass. Joyce knew what he was doing. He had always had an uncanny knack for finding four-leaf clovers, and he loved to present them to her as small tokens of his affection. How he found them so easily mystified her, but he always told her that it wasn't a matter of luck at all, that it was just a matter of keeping your eyes open. The only time you don't find a four-leaf clover, he liked to say, is when you stop looking for one. She loved that. It summed up in a few words what she most loved about him. She lay back in the grass and closed her eyes, enjoying the warmth of the sun on her face and legs. After a short while, shorter than usual, she heard Joe approaching. She sat up and smiled at him. "Found one," he said, beaming. He held out a closed fist, and she reached out to receive the clover. But as he slowly unfolded his hand, she saw that it held not a clover, but a golden ring, with a small but perfect diamond sparkling in the rare spring sunshine. Chapter 5. Rowing is perhaps the toughest of sports. Once the race starts, there are no timeouts, no substitutions. It calls upon the limits of human endurance. The coach must therefore impart the secrets of the special kind of endurance that comes from mind, heart, and body. George Yeoman Pocock. As the autumn of 1933 began to wane, daytime temperatures in Seattle sagged into the low 40s, evening temperatures into the 20s. The perpetually somber skies began to drizzle relentlessly. Biting winds blew in from the southwest, kicking up legions of white caps on Lake Washington. On October 22, gale winds ripped display signs from buildings downtown, tossed houseboats around on Lake Union, and necessitated the rescue of 33 people from various storm-tossed pleasure craft on Puget Sound. For the boys still competing for a spot on the freshman crew, the deteriorating weather meant new forms of misery as they labored at their oars aboard Old Nero. Rain pelted their bare heads and shoulders. Their oars slapped against wind-tossed waves, sending up plumes of icy spray that blew back into their faces and stung their eyes. Their hands grew so numb that they could never be sure they had a proper hold on their oars. They could not feel their ears or noses. The icy water of the lake beneath them seemed to suck warmth and energy out of them more quickly than they could produce it. Their aching muscles cramped up the moment they stopped moving them, and they dropped like flies. By October 30th, the original 175 had been whittled down to 80 boys competing for a seat in the first two freshman boats. There would be a third boat and a fourth boat, too, but nobody sitting in them would be likely to find himself racing in the spring or having a shot at eventually making the varsity crew. Tom Bowles decided it was time to move the best of them out of Old Nero and into shell barges. Both Joe Rance and Roger Morris were among those he chose. The shell barges were much like the racing shells the boys aspired to sit in, but they were a few inches broader in the beam, with flatter bottoms and keels. Considerably more stable than racing shells, they were nevertheless eccentric craft, easy to capsize and difficult to maneuver. What had been true before was true all over again. They would have to master an entirely new set of skills simply to remain upright in them. For now, though, it was enough simply to be out of Old Nero and in something resembling a shell. And Joe, for one, was bursting with pride as he first sat down in one and laced his feet into the foot stretchers. For both Joe and Roger, making it into the shell barges was sweet recompense for days that had been, ever since school began, brutally long and demanding. Every weekday, Roger slogged on foot the 2.5 miles from his parents' house in Fremont to school, labored at his engineering classes until crew practice, and when practice was over, walked back home again to help out with family chores and do his homework. On Friday and Saturday nights, to pay his tuition and help with the home finances, he played saxophone and clarinet in a swing band, the Blue Lyres, he had started in high school. On weekends, he worked for his family's moving business, the Franklin Transfer Company, hoisting sofas and bed sets and pianos in and out of homes all over town. With almost half the mortgages in America delinquent that fall, and 1,000 foreclosures occurring every day, it was often sad work as he moved families out of homes they had worked a lifetime to acquire. Too often, men stood hollow-eyed, and women wept in doorways as Roger loaded onto a truck the last of their possessions, destined not for another home, but for an auction house. Each time it happened, Roger whispered a little prayer of gratitude that so far his own family had managed to hang on to their house. Like so many, they had slipped in a few short years from a comfortable, secure, middle-class existence to one in which every dime seemed harder to come by than the one before. But at least they still had their home. Roger was a funny sort of fellow, kind of gruff, apt to speak bluntly, almost rudely. He wasn't easy to buddy up to, but sometimes Joe sat with him in the cafeteria. They talked sporadically, mostly chatting awkwardly about their engineering classes. As often as not, they ate in silence. There seemed to be a tenuous, if unspoken, strand of affection and respect growing between them. But otherwise, Joe didn't feel much kinship with most of the boys in the shell house. Even with the most nattily dressed boys now gone, he still felt that he stuck out among the survivors. He showed up every day in the same rumpled sweater, the only one he owned, and almost every day there were snide remarks about it in the locker room. "Hobo Joe," the boys snickered. "How's life down in Hooverville? You trying to catch moths with that thing, Rance?" Joe took to arriving early to change into his rowing clothes before the others showed up. Every afternoon he hurried from his engineering classes to crew practice. Directly afterward he rushed again, this time to his job in the student athletic store, where he worked until midnight, selling everything from candy bars to what an ad for the store euphemistically termed "those guardians of the vital zone." After work he trudged up University Avenue in the rain and the dark to the YMCA, where he worked as a janitor in exchange for a small, cell-like room just big enough for a desk and a bed. It was just one in a warren of such rooms that had been partitioned off in a converted coal storage basement. The dank, dingy rooms housed an eclectic collection of students, both male and female. Among them was a precocious and stunning young drama student named Francis Farmer, who, less than 2 years later, the rest of them would be watching on the silver screen. But there was little in the way of socializing among the denizens of the basement, and for Joe, his room represented little more than a place to do his homework and stretch out his aching frame for a few hours before heading off to classes again in the morning. It was not like anything one could call a home. As grueling as the fall of 1933 was for Joe, it wasn't quite all work and loneliness. Joyce was nearby, and that was a consolation. She had come to Seattle to be with Joe, but also to pursue her own dreams. Her academic success set her on a course that was different from those of most of the farm girls with whom she had gone to high school in Squim. She didn't seek a career outside her home. She wanted to raise a family and do it very well. But she had no intention of living a life like her mother's, in which housework defined and limited the horizon of her worldview. She wanted to live a life of the mind, and the university was her ticket to that life. Ironically, though, the only route to her goal lay through still more housework. She walked off a ferry and arrived in downtown Seattle that September, desperately needing a place to live and a way to pay for her tuition, her food, and her books. She enrolled at the university and moved in briefly with her Aunt Laura, but it was soon clear that, what with the hard times, another mouth to feed was an unwelcome burden on her aunt's already crimped budget. For the next 2 weeks, Joyce arose every morning at dawn and hurriedly scanned the all-too-meager offerings of the Help Wanted ads in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Many days fewer than half a dozen ads appeared, alongside long columns of Work Wanted ads. Aside from a bright mind, all Joyce could reasonably offer the world of employers was her skill at doing what she least liked to do, cleaning and cooking. So she focused on ads for domestic service. Unwilling to pay for bus fare, dressed in her Sunday best, she walked miles each time she found an ad for a maid, trekking far out into the fashionable Laurelhurst neighborhood, east of the campus, or climbing the steep incline up to the crest of Capitol Hill, where stately Victorian houses stood on quiet, shady side streets. Time and again she was met at the door by the haughty wives of the city's elite, who ushered her into stuffy front rooms, perched her on ornate sofas, and then demanded references and evidence of her employment experience, neither of which Joyce could offer. Finally, one hot afternoon, after another disheartening interview in Laurelhurst, Joyce decided simply to start knocking on doors. The houses here were massive and elegant. Perhaps someone needed help and hadn't gotten around to placing an ad. She walked up and down the street, her swollen and arthritic feet aching, sweat building up under her arms, her hair growing damp and disheveled as she traipsed up long walkways to formidable front doors and rapped gently. Late that day, a gaunt-looking elderly gentleman, a prominent local judge, came to his door, heard her out, cocked his head, studied her carefully, but asked no difficult questions about references or experience. There was a long, awkward silence as the judge contemplated her. Finally, he croaked, "Come back in the morning. We'll see if you fit in the last maid's uniform." The uniform fit, and with that, Joyce had landed a job. Now, on weekend evenings when she could get some time off, she and Joe could board a streetcar for a few cents and go downtown to catch a Charlie Chan or Mae West movie for 40 cents. Friday nights were college nights at Club Victor, which meant no cover charge and a chance to dance to the offerings of a local bandmaster, Vic Myers. Saturdays often brought a football game, and every football game called for a dance afterward in the women's gym. Joe and Joyce went to nearly all of them, Joe springing for the 25-cent admission. But dancing on a basketball court to the blaring of the school band wasn't particularly romantic, wasn't really much better than dancing in the close, sweaty confines of the chicken coop back in Squim. Joe couldn't do what he most wanted to do, to take Joyce out to the swank places downtown that many of her friends frequented. They were the kinds of places where Joyce might have worn a chiffon gown, and Joe a suit, if either had had such a thing. Places like the Trianon Ballroom at 3rd and Wall, with its vast, polished maple dance floor capable of holding 5,000 at a time, its glittering chandeliers, its pink walls painted with tropical scenes, and its silver clamshell hood suspended over the bandstand. At places like that, you could dance all night to the likes of the Dorsey Brothers and Guy Lombardo. Joyce professed not to care, but it pained Joe that he could not take her there. In mid-November, the campus crackled with excitement and anticipation as the annual homecoming game with the University of Oregon approached. As a prelude, Joe and his freshman crewmates took on the varsity crew in a football game of their own and were unceremoniously crushed by the older boys. It was a loss the freshmen wouldn't forget, and they swore they would have their revenge on the water. In the meantime, though, tradition demanded that the losers prepare a banquet for the victors, and the student paper, the University of Washington Daily, seized on the opportunity to jibe the freshman crew. Their menu should be easy to select, for they caught plenty of crabs on Sunday. On November 17th, a pall fell over the campus when, just at the height of the festivities, tragedy struck. A freshman, Willis Thompson, attempting to start a bonfire for a rally, splashed gasoline on his clothes and set himself afire. After lingering in great pain for several days, Thompson died the following week. A pall of another, quite literal sort, continued to hang over the larger world as well that month. On November 11th, farmers in the Dakotas awoke after a windy night to find something they had never seen before. Daytime skies turned black by topsoil, scoured from their fields and carried aloft by the wind. The next day, the skies over Chicago grew dark as the dust cloud traveled eastward. And a few days later, people in upstate New York looked up, astonished, into skies the color of rust. Nobody knew it yet, but the dust that month, that first black blizzard, was merely a harbinger of what would come to be called the Dust Bowl, the second great act in the long tragedy of the 1930s and early 1940s. The winds of November 1933 would soon be followed by others, even stronger, that would blow away much of the topsoil of the American plains and send hundreds of thousands of refugees streaming westward across the continent in search of jobs that did not exist. Adrift, rootless, homeless, dispossessed of their own land, their confidence as well as their livelihoods carried away on the wind. And increasingly there were distant but dark rumblings from Germany, intimations of the third and most tragic act. On October 14th, Hitler had abruptly quit the League of Nations and discontinued Germany's ongoing disarmament talks with France and her allies. It was a deeply disturbing turn of events, essentially abrogating the Treaty of Versailles and undermining the foundations on which European peace had been built since 1919. Krupp, Germany's legendary armament and munitions manufacturer, had begun secretly working on an initial order of 135 Panzer I tanks. Observers in Panama had recently noted an enormous surge in the number of shipments of nitrates used in the manufacturing of munitions, passing through the canal under blind sailing orders en route from Chile to the Azores, heading in the direction of Europe, ultimate destination unknown. On the streets of German cities that fall, Americans and other foreign nationals were assaulted by stormtroopers when they refused to give Nazi salutes, prompting the United States, Britain, and Holland to issue warnings to Berlin of most serious consequences should the attacks continue. By late fall, reports were reaching as far as Seattle. Richard Tyler, Dean of Engineering at the University of Washington, just back from Germany himself, reported his observations in an article in the Daily. "The people of Germany today are afraid to express opinions even on trivial matters," he said, before going on to observe that anyone saying anything that could be interpreted as unflattering to the Nazis was liable to be arrested and incarcerated without trial. And though neither Tyler nor any of his readers yet knew it, the Nazis had in fact already imprisoned thousands of political dissidents in a camp they had opened in March near the charming little medieval village of Dachau. Tyler's account, and scores of others even more sinister, particularly those by Jewish emigrants from Germany, fell almost entirely on deaf ears in America that fall. When the student body at Washington was polled on the question of whether the United States should ally itself with France and Britain to oppose Germany, the results were the same as they had been in similar polls nearly everywhere else in the country. 99% said no. On November 15th, Will Rogers neatly and characteristically summed up the American attitude toward the prospect of a second French-German conflict with a simple homespun image. "The United States," he said, "ought to Just let those two old tomcats, whose tails are tied together over the fence, alone, and try to cure the scratches we got the last time we tried to untie them. On the afternoon of November 28th, the last practice day of the fall term, the freshmen took one final frigid workout. When the last of them had returned to the shell house, Coach Bowles told the boys to stick around, that it was time to announce who had made the first and second boats. Then he ducked into Al Ulbrichsen's office. The boys glanced at one another, through the steamy panes of the glassed-in cubbyhole that served as the coach's office. They could see Ulbrichsen and Bowles hunched over a desk in their flannel suits, studying a piece of paper. The shell house reeked sourly of sweat and damp socks and mildew, as it did every afternoon, now that the rainy season had begun. The afternoon's last feeble light filtered down from the windows above. Occasional gusts of wind buffeted the massive sliding door. As the two coaches lingered in the office, the boys' usual post-practice banter and joshing faded away and was replaced by an uncomfortable silence. The only sound was a soft tapping. Up in the loft at the back of the room, Pocock was nailing together the frame for a new shell. Roger Morris drifted over and stood quietly next to Joe, toweling his hair dry. Bowles emerged from the office and climbed up onto a bench, clutching the piece of paper. The boys shuffled into a semicircle around him. He began by saying that this was just a preliminary selection, that all of them could continue to compete for the seats he was about to announce, that he encouraged them to do so, that nobody should get all swell-headed just because he heard his name called out now. Nobody should think he was a sure thing. There wasn't any such animal. Then he began to read off the names on the list, moving first through the assignments for the second boat, announcing the names of boys who would make up the primary challengers to the presumptive favorites in the first freshman boat. When Bowles finished announcing the second boat, Joe glanced at Roger, who was staring morosely down at the floor. Neither of them had been called, but neither had long to wait. Bowles began calling out the first boat assignments. Bow seat, Roger Morris. Number two seat, Shorty Hunt. Number three seat, Joe Rance. As Bowles continued, Joe clenched his fist at his side and gave it a subtle little pump, unwilling to celebrate any more demonstrably than that in front of the boys who had not been selected. Next to him, Roger began to exhale softly. As the rest of the boys headed toward the showers, those selected for the first boat took a shell barge off its rack, hoisted it over their heads, and marched it down to the darkening lake for a celebratory row. A light but cutting wind ruffled the water. As the sun set, they laced their feet into the stretchers and began to row westward through the Cut and Portage Bay and out onto Lake Union, seeking calmer water than could be found on the open expanse of Lake Washington. The temperatures had fallen into the upper 30s, and it felt even colder out on the water. Joe hardly noticed. As the boat slipped onto the surface of Lake Union, the noise of city traffic fell away, and he entered into a world completely silent except for the rhythmic barking of the coxswain in the stern. Joe's seat slid methodically and silently back and forth on the greased runners beneath him. His arms and legs pulled and pushed smoothly, almost easily. When the white blade of his oar entered the black water, it merely murmured. At the north end of the lake, the coxswain called out, "Way enough!" The boys stopped rowing, and the shell glided to a stop, the long oars trailing in the water alongside them. Dark clouds, fringed with silver moonlight, scudded by overhead, carried briskly along by the winds aloft. The boys sat without talking, breathing heavily, exhaling plumes of white breath. Even now that they had stopped rowing, their breathing was synchronized, and for a brief, fragile moment, it seemed to Joe as if all of them were part of a single thing, something alive with breath and spirit of its own. To the west, silver headlights crawled slowly across the spidery steel arch of the new Aurora Bridge. To the south, the amber lights of downtown Seattle danced on the waves. Atop Queen Anne Hill, ruby-red lights on radio towers winked on and off. Joe gulped huge drafts of the frigid air and sat staring at the scene, watching it turn into a soft blur of colors as, for the first time since his family had left him, tears filled his eyes. He turned his face to the water, fiddling with his oarlocks so the others would not see. He didn't know where the tears had come from, what they were all about, but something inside him had shifted. if only for a few moments. The boys had caught their breaths, and they were talking softly, not joking for a change, not horsing around, just talking quietly about the lights and what lay before them. Then the coxswain called out, "Ready all!"